2 months ago, we stopped production on Story in the public square when our governor issued a stay-at-home order. So we stayed home and we watched the days pass. Today's guest, though, could not stay home. She's a pulmonary and critical care specialist on the front lines of the COVID-19 pandemic. She's Dr. Daniela Lamas this week. Story in the public square. Welcome to Story in the Public Square, where storytelling meets public affairs. I'm Jim Lutis from the Pell Center at Salve Regina University. I'm joined virtually today by my great friend and colleague, G. Wayne Miller of the Providence Journal. We're coming to you from three different locations today. Like everybody else, we've been disrupted and displaced by the COVID-19 pandemic. But we're thrilled to be joining you today, and we're even more thrilled to have our first guest back, being an old friend, Dr. Daniela Lamas. Daniela is a pulmonary care and critical care specialist at Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston, one of the world's great hospitals. She's also an incredibly talented writer. And for the last several months, she's been on the front lines of the COVID-19 pandemic. Daniela, thank you so much for being with us. And thank you to you and all of your colleagues in the healthcare profession around the world who are out there fighting for us every day.
And I'll second that. Thanks so much. You've saved many lives.
Thanks for the opportunity to be here.
Well, it's great to see you again. One of the questions that you're an incredibly talented writer too. And last time you were on the show, we were talking about your book, You Can Stop Humming Now. And one of the questions that I found myself as I've read some of the pieces that you've written in the New York Times and elsewhere in the last couple of months, question that I guess I wanted to come with was, you know, how are you as a healthcare professional in the front line personally, sort of coping with the enormity of what you're facing?
You know, I think I've wondered to myself, and maybe it seems like a silly question, but I've wondered to myself, why does this feel different? And I'm in the Brigham and Women's Medical Intensive Care Unit generally, and when I'm on service, when I'm working in the hospital, and that's a sad unit. We have patients from Dana-Farber Cancer Institute largely, and so we have a lot of patients who are extraordinarily sick, and many of them pass away. There was a day just before COVID, I remember, because it was the day before Friday the 13th, so it was March 12th, before we were getting a lot of our COVID patients in Boston. And on that day, we had 4 deaths in our intensive care unit, and that had nothing to do with COVID. Those were mostly cancer. And I remember thinking to myself and my team looking around and thinking, well, it's not gonna get worse than this. And, because we saw the numbers of COVID cases beginning to rise, Biogen had already happened in Boston, and we thought, this is sort of as bad as it gets. And COVID, even still, COVID has been different. You know, even despite sort of seeing and never become used to death in the ICU, each one is tragic, but this is different because these are people who are previously healthy largely. And these are people whose sort of lives were just taken by storm in the midst of this terrifying time. And maybe even sort of more tragically, or to add to things, this disease itself demands isolation. And so, you know, our units are full of people who haven't seen families in weeks. As now people have been sick for a long time, I have people who haven't seen their families in months, more than a month.
We want to talk to you about that. We want to talk to you about the loneliness dynamic, because you've written really eloquently about that. But before we get to that, let's talk a little bit about where are we right now in the course of this pandemic? You've got sort of a sliver of a view of where we are in Boston, but give us your sense of where you think, you know, we're taping this the third week in May. Where do you think we are right now in the course of this pandemic?
You know, I think we've passed the apex. You know, we see here in Brigham and in our other hospitals in Boston, and we see in other, you know, cities throughout the country, New York City, that the numbers of new admissions and admissions in the hospital have decreased significantly. I think that we're at a point where everybody is sort of looking around and wondering what comes next. And I think that that's where we're at in multiple levels. We're at wondering how can we safely begin to live in the world again, because we can't press pause forever. And we're wondering how we can make sure that we're safe when sort of the world begins, and be ready for the fact that there will be more cases. And I think from the patient population, you know, we're seeing people beginning to, or not beginning, we're seeing people surviving this. And we're getting the sense that there is, and the knowledge that there's going to be a whole sort of new population that this pandemic has created of survivors of coronavirus, and what that looks like. And so I think we're in this sort of, you know, after the apex, looking around and saying, all right, how can we move forward? But knowing that things won't go back to the way they were before, that we're in a different place now.
I want to get into, or have you get into, a little bit of the emotional and mental health toll. This has taken, obviously, on patients, loved ones, families, and also healthcare workers in your field. I've written about this for the Providence Journal because I'm doing COVID coverage for them. But what's your perspective on that? Are we going to be looking at mental health issues down the line? What are people doing now to try to preserve, you know, their mental health in the midst of all this trauma and stress?
You know, I think mental health for healthcare workers is something that, you know, is an issue that has existed before COVID. And now the thing that makes it so different, I guess twofold. One, just the magnitude of patients and of suffering, and of, again, and we'll talk about it specifically, but the isolation, the not having families, the fact that people have these memories now of, you know, holding up phones to somebody's ear as they're dying, these memories that are really a lot to carry. And, you know, and coupled with the fact that that people, you know, feel like they are putting themselves at risk. And that just adds a layer of, you know, deep anxiety and fear to every day that I think sort of heightens this, you know, mental health issue. In my hospital, you know, what really can you do? You can definitely do things, but at the same time, like, we are taking care of these patients, and that involves some risk. To be honest, less so for doctors like me, more so for the nurses who are in those rooms, like, every moment, more so for the respiratory therapists who are the ones that go in and suction these patients. So that risk is also, I think, unequally applied, which I think adds to stress. That being said, you know, I think acknowledging the fact that this is not a regular time. In my hospital, we've had abilities to debrief with sort of clinicians who are psychiatrists or trained in therapy, and that's helpful, just to be able to share stories. For me personally, writing is very helpful, to be able to share stories and to sort of get feedback from that, and to not feel sort of equally, you know, additionally isolated. But I think as this wanes, and as the adrenaline, because you can only keep up adrenaline for so long, as that adrenaline sort of wanes, I think what we are going to be seeing people looking around and saying, hey, I haven't slept in weeks, you know, I need help. And I think that's something that we have to be ready for.
I would just add one thing about your writing. It's therapeutic for you. I think it's therapeutic for other people as well. You know, I've read all of your stuff, all of your op-ed essays in the New York Times, and they're very moving and powerful. It's amazing storytelling, but it's also helpful, I think. It's therapeutic. So, you know, just amazing work.
I mean, that is really meaningful to hear, because I wonder about the drive to tell those stories and not just to put them in a journal. You know, why don't I journal? Why do I feel the need to publish it? And what does that say, and sort of where does that drive come from? So knowing that these stories are helpful in some way to others is important.
Okay. How do you answer that question? I'm going to force you to answer your inner dialogue in a public forum. So how do you answer that question?
I mean, I started it, obviously. You know, I think my worry when I answer that question is that in some way there's a self-serving aspect to choosing to write in a public forum instead of journaling, per se, or telling the story to a friend. My hope, though, is that, and what I believe to be true, is that stories particularly now, are essential for understanding, to document what is going on. Right now, we don't have reporters in the hospital. You know, we don't have pictures, really, of what's happening in the intensive care unit. The ones that we have had are so powerful because they're so few. And I think that only sort of through these stories, A, it's important to say, you know, we were here, this is what it was like. But also, I hope that it can sort of shift public understanding of what really this is, of the fact that this is happening, when it's easy to see, to not sort of see it in the outside world. And then ideally stories as change agents, you know, my hope in writing about something, sometimes it is a story to tell a story, but it's sometimes it's to spark questions and ideally spark change.
So you had an essay, excuse me, you had an essay in the Times today, and as Jim said, we're nearing the end of May, and it was titled, "To My Patients' Families, I hope I held the iPad still enough so that it didn't shake while you were saying the things you would regret not saying." I mean, that headline alone is so powerful. I want to read just one quick passage from that, and then if you can sort of dissect that essay and how you wrote it. And let me just read this. "The restricted visitor policies apply not only to those who are diagnosed with coronavirus, but to everyone, people with cancer and transplants and heart failure. I should say I'm sorry to them too, then. Scared and sick and alone in solitary rooms in the cancer wing of my hospital, bald and nauseated from chemotherapy, awaiting news of bone marrow transplants or another round of treatment, looking out the window, waiting for someone they love to drive by so that maybe they can wave. Their hospital course will inevitably be harder without an advocate at the bedside." You can see I'm getting emotional just reading it. Walk us through that. It's such powerful storytelling.
Thank you. I've been thinking a lot about this visitor policy that we have since its inception, which was about the third week of March, and so about 2 months ago now. And the Brigham, along with hospitals throughout the country, made the decision that essentially this virus was too uncontrolled. And if we were to possibly maintain social distancing within the hospital, we had to cut down on the number of people who are wandering around. And that meant no visitors, largely no visitors, except for at the extreme, sort of the end of life, the very end of life, really. One person in the ending hours of life was the initial rule, or at a birth. And you know, I thought about this as something that was sort of a tragic consequence of the pandemic, but unavoidable. And I didn't question it or really, I noted its repercussions, but didn't sort of think through its repercussions for the other patients and for all our patients until, you know, sort of repeated events of noting that, my gosh, my patients are deeply lonely. There are people who are in the hospital for weeks and weeks and they don't have family members. So it's not just, oh, they don't have like the fun of somebody to talk to. Like, yeah, these family members, I mean, as I'm sure both of you know through personal experience or experience of others, you know, family members are a key component of care. And not only do they sort of give, help mitigate loneliness, they also are an advocate for a patient. They notice when something is going wrong. They attend rounds with us and help us make sure that we're doing the right thing for a person. And by being there, they sort of observe care and see that we've tried. They are part of the entire trajectory of care. So if things do not ultimately go well, they were there throughout it all, not just called in the last minutes. And I think the hospital is so much of a lonelier place, and care is worsened in a way by not having family members. And so my goal is, with sort of, you know, rethinking this, is to say, as we see things opening, I think we need to recognize that this was a huge deal, which I think we all do, and think about how we can bring people back in a safe fashion.
We need to take a quick moment for station identification. This is Story in the Public Square, where storytelling meets public affairs. An audio version of this show can be heard 4 times every weekend on Sirius XM Satellite Radio's popular Politics of the United States. That's the POTUS channel, number 124. We produce Story in the Public Square with a great crew at Rhode Island PBS, and we're lucky to work with them. I'm Jim Lutis, On most days, you can find me running the Pell Center at Salve Regina University in beautiful Newport, Rhode Island. If you want to connect with me on Twitter, you can do so at JM Lutis. Joining me as he does every week in the co-host chair is my friend, G. Wayne Miller. He's an award-winning journalist with the Providence Journal and the author of 17 books. You can find Wayne on Twitter, too, at G. Wayne Miller. And our guest this week is Dr. Daniela Lamas, one of the doctors working on the front lines of the fight against COVID-19. She's a pulmonary and critical care doctor at Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston, and she's on Twitter, too, at Daniela Lamas, M.D. That's D-A-N-I-E-L-A-L-A-M-A-S-M-D. Danielle, I'm wondering, you know, how has this experience changed you as a physician? Has it changed you as a physician, from you know, the basic how you approach entering a patient's room to the way you deliver care? Has it had an impact on that most intimate part of being a doctor?
I think it's hard to know, sort of at this point, to what extent it's changed sort of how I am as a doctor in a longer term way. You know, I know that the daily practices are different. I mean, I was on last night, and a couple of patients had small events. One was upset with something, and he's sort of starting to wake up and was somewhat delirious and pulling on tubes and lines. And in a regular situation, I would just walk right into the room. You know, I'd walk right into the room and I'd talk to him. And I would have done that many times before. Here, you know, we had this conversation, well, who's going to put on the PPE? Who's going to go in the room? The nurse has to go in anyway. There wasn't a need for multiple people. So the nurse went in, she talked to the patient. It was okay. But I lost that bit of rapport. You know, I lost that moment with a patient. And one of a million moments with patients that we've lost. And that's driven by the fact that putting on and taking off PPE adds a risk each time. You know, when there's scarcity of PPE, which there's still to some degree, though not nearly the way it was, weeks ago, you don't want to increase visits into a room. And this patient's wife probably would have been around. You know, she loves him deeply. She wants to be there, but thankfully he's not at the end of life. He's in the middle of a long illness, and there isn't really a loophole for somebody in the middle of a long illness to have a family member just because they are lonely, because they're confused. And so I think just seeing the way that care is different and the way that our ability to connect with people and their families has become so limited is really frustrating. It's really frustrating and it's sad. And I think I don't know quite yet how that will change me in a longer term way, because I'm still sort of in it.
So I've asked this question of a number of doctors and nurses, frontline people, respiratory therapists down here in Rhode Island. And I'm going to ask it of you. And on one level, it seems like sort of a silly question, but I think it's also meaningful. Did you ever in your training expect to be working in a pandemic?
No, you know, so I remember, early March, or maybe even, no, it was actually probably at some point in February. We were sort of starting to hear about coronavirus, probably beginning of February then, maybe even January. Anyway, it was a point at which coronavirus was not in the US as far as we knew. And we were told that some of us had our upcoming fit testing for personal protective equipment, which is something that you do, you're supposed to do it about every year. To be honest, I'd let a couple of years lapse, I'm sure. And basically, the people who are in charge of testing you to make sure that your PPE fits appropriately put like a large weird bag over your head with a little hole in it. They put you in the PPE, then they spray this saccharin flavored sort of powder into this bag that you have around your head. And then you read a poem that has something to do with rainbows. Seriously. And then you tell them whether the reading of the poem and then sequential squats and putting your head from side to side, whether you taste the saccharin. And if you taste the saccharin, your mask doesn't fit. If you don't taste the saccharin, it fits. So I've done this many times over the years. And even in this last time, you know, I thought, we're doing this. I always do this PPE thing. Yeah, probably, you know, it's important to make sure my N95 fits, but ultimately it's this goofy thing where you're getting saccharine and you're reading a poem about a rainbow and none of it really matters. It matters, but it doesn't really matter. You're not afraid of it. So then 5 or 6 weeks later, when I'm putting on my N95 for that first patient with coronavirus, I panicked. You know, did I actually taste the saccharine? Was I not reading the poem about the rainbow right? You know, like, suddenly this all mattered. And I never expected any of this to matter. I think it's still hard to really put my mind around the fact that we are in the midst of a pandemic. You know, I feel it sometimes, like when I see the few times we have families come in for a patient who's toward the end of life, and I see these terrified people, you know, putting on the masks that we give them, putting on their contact isolation gowns, and standing in front of this person that they love, and they look so scared. And I think, wow, you know, these are people who are probably going to lose somebody in the setting of a pandemic. Like, this is where we are all in this now. And it sort of gives me chills. And so it's this interesting sort of pendulum of feeling that you're in something so unexpected, and then sort of not realizing what you're in. So no, I never expected it.
So it's a surreal atmosphere is the word I've used. It's dystopian. So I want to switch gears here a little bit. Last time we spoke was a few months ago before coronavirus. And at that time you were and you are still a writer on a Fox hit show, The Resident. Tell us about that. I mean, there's another writing gig. I mean, how many gigs do you have actually? How did you come to that, and what did that do, and what is the future of the show? Because it has paused production for now.
So I've always loved medical television shows. I mean, I've watched all of ER twice. Some of it more than that. I'm actually fully up to date on Grey's Anatomy, which is definitely something that I shouldn't advertise, and yet I just did. And I don't watch it ironically. Like, I really enjoy all of these shows.
Well, it is a great show. A great show. We love it too.
I've always loved this stuff. And so, you know, because I liked to write, I had always thought, what if I could be part of a medical television show? And so I've bothered people over the years, sent emails that go unanswered. And just basically through a sequence of sort of fortuitous events, the creator of The Resident responded to a Facebook message that I sent her, actually. And this ended up getting me a gig on the show, which this past season was my first sort of full season on the show as a writer. And you know, it's a fascinating experience. I mean, generating fiction about medicine while you're also intermittently, you know, I was still doing clinical time at the Brigham throughout this. Is an extraordinarily fun and it's fascinating thing to see patients and say, this story could be a story for television, and then turn it into something, and then, you know, a couple months later see an actor act it out based on something that you experienced. Go ahead.
Well, I'm just curious that, you know, does, you know, I remember after 9/11, there was a moment where we thought that all narrative storytelling was going to be a reflection on what happened in 9/11. And there were some examples of that, but it didn't really, it didn't have the broad societal impact that I think, you know, we've all lived at home for the last 3 months. Do you expect that fictional medical dramas on television are going to spend all of their, once they're able to get back into production, are they going to be all focused on COVID? Or do you think how do you think that's going to play out?
I mean, I've thought a lot about that, needless to say. And I think, and this is really just, you know, it's obviously just my opinion, I think that a show that relies on some degree of veracity, you know, of saying we are showing things that exist in the real world, dramatized, but exist in the real world, I think they would lose a lot of their credibility if they don't sort of acknowledge that this happened. You know, do we need a show that tells a sequence of COVID stories? Is the public even have the appetite for that? I'm not sure. But I think when shows start again, I feel like it would be odd to have people who are playing doctors and not at least say this happened. In the interim time between when we last saw you, this happened, we've gone through this.
Well, let me ask you this question, because the you know, whether you're telling a fictionalized story of an account of something you've seen, or you're doing some of this incredible essay writing you've done in the New York Times and elsewhere, if there was one thing that you could say to the American public right now, what would it be?
I'm trying to say something that doesn't sound really cliche, but there's something in my head that's on along the lines of thank you. You know, people have been amazing. I mean, to see these people, I feel so lucky that I get to go into work and I haven't been at risk of losing a job, and I'm able to do things during the day that I'm able to interact with a ton of other people. Like, yes, we are at some risk. Yes, we are taking care of patients with coronavirus, but we're doing something. We're helping and we're busy. And there are people, though, so many people in this country who just put aside their lives. They've put aside their livelihoods. They've perhaps lost their jobs, and they have stayed at home because that is makes them safer. But it's not just about them. It is saying that I am part of a society where we're all making the decision to do this because it's going to allow us all to move forward. And I think that kind of quiet heroism is really powerful. And I think that has mattered. So everything that everybody has done has mattered.
And, you know, of course, it isn't simply in the healthcare profession. It's so many people that until this were undervalued or underappreciated, from, you know, from clerks to food service people to delivery people, to drivers. The list is long. And if I hate the term silver lining, but if there is one, and there's probably more than one, I think it's recognition of these people as such valuable members of our society, people that you didn't think of before necessarily, and they have stepped up too as well.
It's so true, and sort of the, not to put a sad part of the silver lining, but those are the patients that we're seeing now. And, you know, the people we're seeing now are the people who were unable to isolate. You know, the initial patients I saw with COVID were people who potentially had been exposed through their international travel, through a Biogen or other conference. You know, these were people who were exposed through privilege. And now all those people have isolated. And the people who have had to keep working, exactly as you said, the delivery people, people who work in nursing homes, people who live in nursing homes, who live in group homes, cab drivers, all of these people, these are the patients that we're seeing now. And so I hope, I strongly hope, you know, that this does not sort of further stratify those who are able to protect themselves from this virus and those who aren't, and that instead it allows us to see those people who are vulnerable and know that we need to build in better systems of protection.
Daniela, that is where we need to leave it. Thank you so much for being with us. She's Dr. Daniela Lamas. Thank you for all that you do. And thank to all of you in the audience for joining us this week for our first virtual version of Story in the Public Square. For G. Wayne Miller, I'm Jim Lutis, asking you to join us again next time for more Story in the Public Square.